So I want to start by saying something which I think is obvious, or it should be. If you started looking at the parsha, it should be obvious, and that is, this is not the easiest parsha. There are certain... Okay, yes, we agree with this. First of all, there's a lot of mitzvot. So on one level, just figuring out why all this mitzvot are here is not easy, which means the mitzvot that we find here, we could have taken them and divided them up. We could have thrown some into Mishpatim, some into Kedoshim, some back into Bamidbar, perhaps. Why are these mitzvot here? Especially new mitzvot that we haven't heard about before, so that then certainly does create a challenge. So I'm saying that's one level. Now, the second problem is the actual mitzvot that are here, which means I don't know how much further you need to go from... There is a challenge over there, and we're going to dance around it, and we're going to try to avoid apologetics, and I don't know how successful we're going to be, but I want to make some observations, which I think is going to, if possible, make the challenge of Eishet Yifat Tohar even more difficult than we normally see it. Okay, so that's not easy because it should be difficult. Now, some of you could be quite religious, and you can say to me, I mean, I never doubt the sincerity of the people in this room and the religious dedication, and therefore you can tell me this is one of the mitzvot of the Torah. You go to war, you find a beautiful woman, and you drag her home. So this is obviously something which is morally acceptable. The problem is that I hope I don't have to convince any of you of this, is that this is morally troubling, and it's not morally troubling because of where I'm sitting today, because of where we're sitting today. If you pay attention to the words of the Torah, certainly if you pay attention to the words of Chazal, and I'm not even going to say to you that there's one voice in Chazal. There is certainly one negative voice in Chazal. I'm not saying it's the only voice, necessarily, but there is certainly a negative voice in Chazal, and that's something that we have to ask ourselves, where did that voice come from? How can they justify themselves? The Torah says this is something which is acceptable. I'm not saying acceptable, therefore it's proper, but there is something when you read this that hopefully you'll understand that there is somewhat some difficulty over here. But before we actually read the beginning of the parsha and we try to figure out what it is that may be negative over here, I do want to look at a larger context. Again, I presume most of us remember what this Eishet Yifat Torah is. You go to war, you see a beautiful woman, and you drag her home. Good. And I just cleaned it up. Okay? Because it may actually be much worse than I just now described it. Last week, we read a beautiful source that says that when you go to war, there are a couple of things that were really interesting about this. One is that you don't surround a city from all sides. You give them a way of escaping. Another thing was that before you go to war, you reach out and you try to create peace. Quite surprising for some of you, especially the bloodthirsty ones among you. The Rambam says this is even a law with Amalek. Right? Even before you go to war with Amalek, you offer to make peace. And some of you can say, but how is that possible? Aren't we supposed to murder them? So according to the Rambam, if they decide to accept the Sheva Mitzvah B'nai Noach, there's no longer an obligation of getting rid of Amalek. So I know that this is quite disappointing to many of you. But therefore, the attitudes of war, that you try to make peace, you lead them away out. What else did we find interesting last week? That we need to have this heightened sensitivity that we don't even chop down all the fruit trees. So look how moral we are. Right? We don't chop down the fruit trees. We try to make peace. We give them a way of escaping. And all of this, I'm pointing towards our sensitivity. If you want to look in this week's parasha, we have more sensitivity. What else do we have? Oh, before you take the eggs, send away the mother bird. Now, don't bother me now. If you're going to say, but I shouldn't say, yeah, this is a question of sensitivity. And I know the Mishnah, I know the Gemara, I know the Rambam. This is a question of sensitivity. So here we're so sensitive that we send away the mother's bird, but yeah, but still you drag home this woman and you're allowed to rape her. So there is something over here which really doesn't work very well when we pay attention. There's a beautiful verse in this week's parasha. The verse is, it's in Perek Kaf Dalet Pasuk Hey. Ki yikach ish isha chadasha. When a man marries a new wife. Ki yikach ish isha chadasha. When a man has a new wife, lo yotze b'tzava, v'lo yavor la v'chol davar, nakia leveito shana echad, v'simach et ishto asher lakach. That's a very beautiful concept. It's from here that people have this whole concept of what they call sometimes shana rishona, that you have to stay home. It's actually halacha. A man, when he gets married for the first year, cannot leave the city that he lives in without permission of his wife, just the first year. Afterwards, you say, when are you going? Okay? But
every year is the first
year. You should really take her out for coffee. at least, right? So this is beautiful. Because again, did you notice something? We have war, we have a wife, and make her happy and cherish her. What is your job? V'simach et ishto asher lakach. So again, I just want to point out that when we look at this Eishi Yifat Torah, and then we compare it to what we're seeing over here, there's some kind of dissonance between these two different sections, and we can go on. For example, we find in this week's parasha a couple of other things which I hope you understand them and see. Again, I don't have a better word right now than dissonance. There is a verse in this week's parasha that talks about rape. Just to start with that. It talks about rape of a married woman. It talks about the rape of a single woman. It talks about the consequences of rape. And rape is considered to be here something which is absolutely severe. There is talk over here about, there are laws here about promiscuity, not rape, about promiscuity between people that are not married and so on. And again, there's talk about prostitution, and there's talk about the wages of prostitution, and all of these things, we have laws against this. And again, I'm just going to ask, so where does Eishi Yifat Torah walk in over here? Did you realize that in this week's parasha, it speaks about kidnapping? Which means, as much as we like to say that when it says in the Seret HaDibrot, and this is the Gemara, Lo Tignov, you shouldn't steal, it's talking about kidnapping, because the Gemara's sensitivity or sensibility is that the stealing over there, or all the Seret HaDibrot should be things punishable, all are capital offenses. So regular stealing is not a capital offense, so therefore the Gemara concludes that it's really referring to a verse in this week's Parsha. It's actually immediately after the verse I just now read you about not going to war and making one's wife happy. I'm skipping one verse in between, which we had a whole shiur on last year or 2 years ago. And now Pasuk Zayin writes, Ki matza ish gonev nefesh me'echav m'nei b'Yisrael v'hit amerbo u'machro u'meita ganavahu v'yarta rami kirbecha. It's a capital offense to do kidnapping. So again, I'm going to ask you what should be a really simple question. And I hope you understand that I just now, within the framework of what I'm creating here, I just now hopefully showed why Eishi Yifat Torah is so much worse than we imagined beforehand, because I'm going to say this again. Anybody with a sense of decency should read these verses and say, there is something incredibly disturbing over here. And I'm going to say it again. Chazal see it, and they understand it. They say it. We're going to have to see why it is. Without, again, there's something here that makes a value judgment. But there are those who can say, hold it, but the Torah says this is allowed, and this is allowed, so who am I, right? How dare you come and say this is something which is not allowed? So I'm going to say it again. Do you realize now the irony? In the same parasha, it's telling you, rape, okay, here are the consequences. Kidnapping, here are the consequences. Now, there is really a basic difference between these various examples, and it's important to state the difference. The difference is one which I think is incredibly important in terms of modern-day politics. Left, right, and no, I'll explain exactly what I mean, but nobody responds. You have to agree to be quiet. Okay? Yes? In terms of politics today, between left and right, there are a couple of basic issues where people see them as being different, or see an incredibly important perspective, which is totally different. So therefore, you're going to have people from the left saying, essentially, this is not our land. We displaced other people. It is their land. We don't have rights to this land. And therefore, everything else is going to follow from that. While the other side is to say, no, fundamentally, this is our land. And biblically or whatever, or legally or whatever you want, this is our land. And therefore, we have rights to it. And this is then going to color your whole perspective. If you think we do have rights, you think we don't have rights, you think it's our land, you think it's their land, that's going to make a difference how you see things. But it's not the only issue. There's another issue which I don't think gets spoken about enough, but I think that this is beneath the surface, and this is going to then take us back to Eshivat Torah. And that is that one of the things that one will hear coming from the side of the left will be something as follows. Today, Israel is strong. Israel's the conqueror. Being the strong one of the conqueror and the majority within this region, we have responsibility of taking care of the minority. Now, every word of that is true. Every word of that is true, morally, legally, that we have responsibility. When we exercise that responsibility, sometimes they don't get all that happy, but we have responsibility. Now, on the other hand, and I think that this is something which is true, though maybe depressing, the current situation is actually one of a war which is taking place, even though the war, and war is a very strong term. If I would tell you that right now Israel's at a state of war, you may disagree with me. The war is on a very low burner. But on the other hand, is it true that every single week we have situations in the army that soldiers have to break Shabbat because of pikuach nefesh situations? Up and down in terms of the borders, in terms of regular activity which is taking place. Why? Because there's a situation over here. Now I'm going to say it again. It is a situation of war which is on a low burner. If you want to look at the situation in Gaza, has the other side declared that there is an ongoing war? So now the question is, to what degree do we agree with them, or to what degree the facts on the ground actually support what they're saying? So when we get attacked, so then it becomes more obvious when there's a lull in the attacks, then we can believe that everything is fine. But essentially, ever since at least 1948, and realistically before 1948, there has been a state of war which has existed over here, with bigger flare-ups, with smaller flare-ups, with different people who we've been fighting with, and certain people have, you know, there are, if not peace treaties, then non-belligerency taking place. But that makes a big difference in terms of your perspective. Now, one of the things is, and this is really what I wanted to get to, I don't know if you know this, but one of the courses that I teach in university is a course on law and ethics. And there is a fundamental difference between ethics in normal life and ethics in a time of war. War essentially has one objective, and that one objective is probably victory, but it's certainly survival. That is the objective of war, which means it's very, very different from normal ethics, which take place in normal everyday life. And again, if you want to think about it on a little bit, on a more of a profound level, then all the things that we're not allowed to do in terms of everyday life suddenly become confusing when you speak about war. There's a beautiful description in source number 8 from Rav Hirsch. He's trying to figure out the list of mitzvot that we have in this week's parasha, which I'm going to say again is difficult, but I hope that now at least you appreciate something that I've said. It's not just that the figuring out the list of mitzvot, what one has to do with the other, is challenging. Now we realize that a number of the mitzvot that we have in this parasha actually absolutely challenge us and contradict the values that we find in some of the other mitzvot over here, as I've been trying to show. But listen to what Rav Hirsch writes and where it's underlined. B'miskeret ha-tipul b'shavui milchama, when it comes to the treatment of the captives in war, machriza Torah al kdushat haminiyut shela isha mul ta'avat hagever. Now that is a very powerful statement, which I will try to translate correctly. He says, when it comes to the treatment of this captive woman, the Torah announces or declares the sanctity of sexuality in terms of this woman in contrast to the base desires of this man. Which means right away it's telling me that there's this incredible conflict which is taking place. And the objective of this law is to protect her from being taken advantage of people, how do you want to translate kal dat? People who are superficial and not deep-thinking individuals. And we find this in other places. And he now gives this example, which I had thought of before. And he goes, now think about the value of war, where it tells us not to go destroying the trees or other things unnecessarily. And we're told later on in this week's parsha as well, that when one goes to war, to make sure to stay away from all kinds of destructive things. What he's referring to now, let's pause here and go back to the previous source in source 6. When you go off to war against your enemies, be careful to stay away from anything which is negative. A person, a man who becomes impure at night, he cannot come into this tent. Now, doesn't this fly in the face of this idea? This is talking about a person having a nocturnal emission, and you come and he says, oh, this person can't enter into the camp. Just continue with this a moment. He has to go to the mikvah, and only then can he then revisit this camp. This is in terms of the morality of going to the bathroom. Why? Because God is among you in order to save you in battle, and your camp, your encampment should be holy. And no immorality should be seen. 1 second, isn't this fascinating? Just in terms of contrasting with the Eshet Vator? Oh yeah, and by the way, but if you see the attractive woman, then drag her home. So when you read this, I'm saying again, there should be this incredible tension which should now be created between the various laws in this week's parsha. Go back to Rav Hirsch. V'nishmartim mikol devarav, lo yirecha b'cha ervat davar, midugmot al yidei halachot enogot b'matzavim shel melchama. These tell us about attitudes of how we behave during war. Shekein b'imei milchama ha'adam note likro dror l'ta'avot heres u'lishliuch resen musari. Okay, translation? Because in times of war, a person moves towards freedom in terms of destructive desires and getting rid of things which normally are controls in terms of morality. Kol ha-mitzvot ha-eila ba'ot l'chayev et ha-matzpun ha-yehudi afilu b'matzav chirigim. And therefore, what we're finding in this week's parasha are things which are intended to control somebody's, how you say, matzpun?
Conscience.
Even in unusual circumstances. And certainly in order to tell us how to behave in normal circumstances. So I want to now say in English what... Well, I was looking for this. I was looking for someone to make this statement. One of the things that I've been doing in the past year is attempting to rewrite my first book, which is, believe it or not, to make all of you feel old, including myself, is that I'm coming on a 20th anniversary edition. Okay, so it's a 20th anniversary from the first book that I wrote. So as I was reading through it, one of the things that I had written in terms of this week's Parsha is that war is morally confusing. Think of all the things we've been told when we're very, very little that you can't do, and then you get drafted in the army and they tell you to do all those things, right? When you're little, you're in kindergarten, what do they tell you? Please don't kill the other children. And now you're told, well, make sure that you kill the enemy. When you're little, you're told, don't take anything from anyone else, right? That belongs to someone else. And here you're told, well, let's take away everything from this other person. Even think of it like this. How many of the Ten Commandments, this is your challenge for today, how many of the Ten Commandments are suspended during war? And Ten Commandments are pretty important in terms of Judaism. So how many of them are suspended in terms of war? And now we can begin to argue about the one, Lo Tinof, whether it's included in terms of, okay, this Eshiva Torah, if she was married, so we don't care all that much. So when I start looking at the Ten Commandments and saying, so now what happened to war in terms of the Ten Commandments? And suddenly I realize that there are these other values. Now, that is not a simple point. So just in terms of the morality, war is morally confusing. During war, you can eat non-kosher food. During war, you can kill. During war, you can take things which are not yours. And actually, sometimes during war, those are the objectives. And Shabbat is suspended as well. Which means that during war, all kinds of values which we've had as growing up as just basic values, those values all fall aside. So now what happens to this soldier as all those values are falling aside? Now, a good soldier is going to be disciplined, and a good soldier is going to follow direct orders. In my initial couple of months in the army, I was in the Rabbanut, and my job was to go into and check the kitchens, make sure everything was kosher. And I can tell you, there was a very simple rule, which was at least 99, maybe 100% true, in my experience at least. If there was a base that there was good discipline generally, and you can see that the second you walk in, you can see the person who's guarding, you can see the uniform, you can see the shoes. If there's good discipline, which means the commanding officer is demanding that you follow the rules, the kitchen is going to be kosher. If there was a lack of discipline, which means the rules don't mean all that much, laxity on the rules, the kind of officer, okay, I'll be friends with the guy and I'm not going to be so strict on certain things, the kitchen is not going to be kosher. Did that make sense? It was a question of discipline versus a lack of discipline, and good soldiers should be disciplined, and good soldiers should be told, this you can do, but this you can't do. Which means if you go back to the question of war, a soldier can't just go take things. War does not allow you to take things individually. The national entity can conquer land. You can go and say, well, we went to war, I'm taking this spoils of war. No, they don't belong to you. That's stealing on an individual level. Which means, again, war is something which is morally confusing. And that is apparently what Rav Hirsch is saying over here. And during this moral confusion is when this woman is seen, but I'm going to say it again. Now go read through the other things in this week's parsha, and we come to this realization that, no, these, you know, before you go to war, and this is Mohammed Rishut, by the way, this is not a Mohammed Mitzvah. During the Mohammed Rishut, right, which is one generally for property or land or so on, which is not one of an existential battle, during this Mohammed Rishut, so not everybody necessarily goes out to war. This is what we read at the end of last week's Parsha. Certain people are excluded from going out to war. Apparently the people who are on a higher moral level are the ones who are going to be chosen for this battle, as opposed to Mohammed Mitzvah, and maybe we'll have time to see this, where everybody would be drafted. So in this kind of battle, we're told that there are rules. And I'm going to say it again, that the rules over here happen to include something which I hope everybody over here before I started found morally troubling. Now, Chazal think there's something very wrong over here. And we'll see Chazal in a moment. But before we see the Chazal, I want to read through the verses in order for us to be able to identify what it is that Chazal saw over here to understand it. And by the way, it could be that I've already done enough. It could be that Chazal noticed that you're not allowed to rape, and Chazal noticed that you're not allowed to steal, you're not allowed to kidnap. There's all kinds of things you can't do. So that should already tell us that there's something morally troubling about this. But there's something else over here, a little bit more specific, which I think is important. So let's take a look. Ki teitzei lemilchama olevecha, source number one, when you go to war against your enemy, unatano Hashem lekech bidecha v'shavita shavyo, and you go and you capture a captive. Now, the truth is that if we really paid attention to last week's parsha, there was something about this that we need to pay attention to, but we're going to ignore it because we're going to make believe that we don't know what it says in last week's parasha, which is pretty good because most of you don't remember what it says in last week's parasha in this context. So let's wait, but it's actually, if I'm not mistaken, the key to understanding this whole section is what was said there, which means the Torah is using this old trick. Please pay attention to what I said last chapter or two chapters ago, because if you don't pay attention to it, then you're not going to follow it. And it's one of these problems that once the Torah is divided into parshiot, that you just start anew, right? When you get to new, okay, this is a new idea. No. We talked about war in various circumstances last week, and various issues came up, including this issue of the captives. So let's make believe we know nothing. V'ra'ita b'shevya eshet yifat Torah. And you see among the captives a beautiful woman, v'chashakhtaba. The word cheshek, okay, what does that word do for you? V'chashakhtaba, what does the word mean? You desire her. So is the word desire in this context, is this a good thing or a bad thing? Let me put it like this. Is this a description, I want to make this so simple, I want to make this very easy that hopefully most of us can get it. Your desire for this particular attractive woman, is this a function of your Yetzer Hara or your Yetzer Tov? Is that a real easy way of dividing the world? And now you'll say, well, how do I know which is my Yetzer Hara and which is my Yetzer Tov? There's a great story with the Chafetz Chaim. He lived, this is actually subject to some argument, how old he was, if he died at 96, 90, 98, 106, and whatever. If you recall the book, was called The Making of a Gadol. So one of the things that was very, very problematic in the book is that the author said that the Chazon Ish was wrong and the Chafetz Chaim died not at 100, and I believe 106, but only at 96. So he argued, I mean, he did some math on this. The Chafetz Chaim was a young man. His father died of a cholera epidemic. The famous cholera epidemic, by the way, that Yisrael Salanter reportedly made Kiddush in the middle of Shul, which never really, on Yom Kippur, which never really happened. That was just a rumor that was spread by the Maskilim in order to try to get Rabbi Yisrael Salanter over to that side. That whole thing never happened. Although there was a cholera epidemic one year, and the Chafetz Chaim's father died. And based on that, if you knew how old the Chafetz Chaim was, then you can do the math to find out how old he was when he died. I forgot that there was an obituary. You can look it up in the New York Times. So whatever they said is wrong. I mean, I don't have to tell you that, but whatever, that's pretty clear. So in this book, The Making of the Gadol talks about how old the Chafetz Chaim was, but there's a story that when he was very old, again, I don't know exactly, 92, 93, 94, when he was very elderly, that one morning he wasn't feeling well. And he wakes up, and he has the following discussion with himself. His name is Yisroel Meir. He goes, Yisroel Meir, you're old, you're tired, you're not feeling well, it's middle of winter, it's in Radin, you should stay in bed, you'll go to the later minyan. So then he jumps up and he runs to shul and he goes to daven. So he tells this over to his son afterwards, and his son said, you know, you had a good point. You are pretty old and you're not feeling well. Maybe you should have rested a little bit more. So he said, my Yetzer Hara is just as old as I am, and he was already working. So then I realized that I can get up as well. Now, it is, but it's not so simple, because how do I know that was the Yetzer Hara? Maybe that was the Yetzer Tov. You need a little more rest. Maybe there are times in our lives that we need to take it easy. We need to take care of ourselves. So I'm going to say it again. In terms of this woman, when you see this woman, is this your Yetzer Tov or your Yetzer Hara? So I got some interesting answers when I gave this class, not exactly this class, but some of, I asked this question to my yeshiva students yesterday. So they have been trained to believe that all women are Yetzer Hara. So I think someone's going to have a conversation with them at some point. Okay. Whenever you guys want to give the lecture, let me know. So I'm gonna say it again. Is this, how do I know? So you know what? Here's the litmus test. I'm not gonna tell you it's as simple as I'm gonna put it right now. The Yetzer Hara is the thing that takes you further away from God. The Yetzer Tov is the thing that brings you closer to God. The word vichashakta, desires, or is right now your desire to come closer to God at this moment? And this whole, I mean, listen, before people get married, I would hope that there is desire, and I would hope that there's love, and I would hope that there is attraction, but I would hope that there's also a sense of holiness, and this is something that will bring completeness, and this is something which is also a function of the Yetzer Tov. That's not the Yetzer Hara totally taking person away from God, quite the opposite. This kind of completion should be something which brings somebody toward God. So the first thing which is suspect over here, well, the first thing is that you're checking out these women. That's the first thing, right? And you see, right, you realize that. You see the Eshet Yifat Torah, okay, that's going to be part of the problem. V'choshakta ba, and you desire her. V'lakachta lacha le'isha. Now that's very interesting. Because is that a description or is that a proscription? V'lakachta lacha le'isha. And you take her as a wife. V'veita el toch beitecha, and you take her to your home. V'gilta et rosha, and you shave her head. V'asta et sipraneha, and her nails get done. The question is what that means. V'hisira et simat shivya me'aleha, and you take away the dress. Now that's also quite interesting. What does that refer to? Hold on. V'yeshva b'veitecha uvachta et aviyo ve'et ima yerech yamim. And then she should cry for her mother and father for a month. And then you should take her and have relations with her. And then she becomes your wife. Now, in this description of the Torah on its simple level, we do have delayed gratification because it only spoke about the consummation of the relationship a month later. We all realize that in the Rabbanut today, it's this easy to do conversions, correct? It takes a month. Change your clothing, cut your hair, and then they approve the conversions, which itself should be quite disturbing. Vayalacha v'haya imlocha vatzdaba, and if you change your mind, you have, what's this called? Buyer's remorse. V'haya imlocha vatzdaba, how would you translate the word chafatzda? I don't want to use the word desire again, because we use that for chashakta. You don't want her. Vishilachta lenafsha, and you send her to herself. Umachar lotim karana bakasef, and you cannot sell her. What does that mean? She's not your property. She's not a slave. Lotit amer, how would you translate? Lotit amer ba, tachat asher inita. What does tit amer mean? You cannot exchange her. Why? Tachat asher inita. That's the price that you have to pay because what's inita? Because you abused her. Now, right there, I knew that we had to get to the very last word in this section to realize that there is a value judgment. What is the value judgment? She. This is abuse. You can say to me, who are you to say that the Torah is saying this is abuse? What's the answer? The Torah is saying this is abuse. The Torah is saying that her hashtag should say me too. She is a victim of abuse. And one second. Do I have to convince any of you that's what the Torah said over here? That's what it says. So if she's a victim of abuse, I don't know, again, this is like higher mathematics. If she's a victim of abuse, then who is her abuser? You. Right. So now how in the world can the Torah allow such abuse? Which means when I now go back and I compare this section to the other things taking place over here, the Torah created a value judgment. I want to say this again. This is not a question of a 21st century read of the texts and saying, oh, I find this morally troubling because I am enlightened and so on. That's not me. This is the Torah making this statement and saying she's not considered property. Now, that itself, really, we need to pay attention to. Why? Tachat asher inita. Because you abused her, which means if you are going to go, now which word do you want to use? Do you want to use the word rape? Yes or no? Why? Because it makes you feel... As far as the woman's perspective, when she writes her memoirs, will she say, will she describe this in romantic terms? Or will she describe how she... But I'm going to ask you again, from her perspective. Because it just now... So you're saying this is better than a cold shower. That's what you're telling me?
Yeah.
Why? Because of the delayed gratification or... Okay. And she gets the credit cards afterwards. She gets full rights as a wife. She gets full rights and privileges as a wife. But no, I accept that it's preventive, but the Torah calls... do you realize what section this should remind you of? Or no? This section should remind you of another portion in the Torah. I'll tell you, if it didn't come immediately to mind. Not at all. Shouldn't remind you of that. Why is your head there? No. This should remind you of something else. This should remind you of the story of Shechem and Dinah. He sees an attractive girl. He takes her. By the way, the same word is used that he abused her. Inui is used in that section as well. But do you realize the beautiful part now? So what role do we take in this story now? So now we just now became Shechem. Oh, that's not a good thing. Do I have to convince you that's not a good thing? To see an attractive girl, to take her and to abuse her. That's the story of Shechem and Dinah. And now the Torah is telling you, oh, by the way, if you want to channel your inner Shechem, okay, this is what you do. And he goes, no, I want to, as a wife, I want a kid. It's the Shechem and Dinah story over here, which just, I'm sorry, don't get mad at me. I'm saying on a linguistic level, there are similar words which are used in both sections over here. He sees her, he desires her, he takes her, he abuses her. He sees her, he takes her, he desires her, he abuses her. What do you want from me? The only thing which is troubling now is, so why exactly the Torah allow it? And I'm going to say it again. As far as the Torah is concerned, is she a victim? Yes. Why am I working so hard? Is she a victim, yes or no? How do you know she's a victim, just in case you weren't sure? Because it says she's a victim. You don't have to work so hard. It says she's a victim. It says she's a victim of abuse. If she's a victim of abuse, it means that she's abused. It means she's a victim. The only word that you seem to have a hard time with is whether she was actually raped or not. And you know what? That will completely depend on what her attitude is at this particular juncture. And let's look at Rashi. Rashi in source number 4 writes, V'lecha lecha le'isha, lo dibra Torah ela keneged yetzahara. When I asked you before the question, is this your Yetzer Tov or Yetzahara? What does Rashi say over here? This whole section is about the Yetzahara. There is no Yetzer Tov being manifest over here. So, that's Rashi. Of course, Rashi is taking this from Chazal, but that's Rashi. She'im ein HaKadosh Baruch Hu matira yisena be'isur. Because had the Torah not found a way to allow it, it would have been done anyway, because that's what happens at war. What happens at war is people rape, and what happens at war is that people bring home brides from the other side. And Rashi actually says, had we not allowed it, yisa'enna bi'isur. Rashi seems to be more troubled that you would have married her anyway, which is very interesting, because it could... If I would have made this up without looking at Rashi, I would have thought that the rape would have been more of the concern. Aval im nasa, soful yod son'a. But if he marries her, he will end up hating her, because again, they don't really have common values or perspectives, and there could be a lot of resentment. Can you imagine the kid later on asking, so how did you and mom meet? Right? Okay, not a good story. Shenemar acharav kitin el leish visofo lidmimenu ben sora umore lekach nismachu parshiot halalu. So Rashi over here is quoting an opinion that tells you that one thing leads to another. But I want you to see the opinion over here. Whoever did this edition of Rashi wrote in parentheses Tanchuma. Rashi, I did not write Tanchuma. The editors do this. Sometimes they get it right, sometimes they get it wrong. Let me just look in my in the edition that I have, which I love, by the way, which is the Art Scroll New Makrot Gedolot, which has Nikud on all of the commentaries. So I challenged some of the things in parentheses afterwards, and they say, no, this, I asked, no, it's in the old manuscripts and so on. And I said, check it up. And apparently it's not in the old manuscripts. It's somebody, they pay someone to put these in. Sometimes they're right, sometimes they're wrong. They're not always right. Over here, there is a Tanchuma like this, but I want you to look at source number 5, which is Devarim Rabbah. Dover Acher. Ben Azay Omer mitzvot gorer mitzvah veira gorer tavera. Where does he say that? In Pirkei Avot. Do you remember that? Okay. So, Ben Azay is of the opinion that mitzvot lead to mitzvot, avera lead to avera. Ketzad. What's he looking for? An example of a mitzvah leading to mitzvah, veira leading to veira. Tiv l'mala ki teitze l'milchamavar ita bishav yam HaKadosh Baruch Hu afal pishir tarti yota l'cha amarti l'cha v'giltat roshav astat sipurneh kidei shelo timtzachei minecha utishlachota. This is exactly what you said before. The Torah creates this whole situation in order for you to send her away. Take her, cut her hair, and make her look unattractive in order to send away. And here you have an example of a sin leading to a sin. Do you notice the value judgment that the Midrash just now said? That taking this Eshiva Torah is, in fact, a sin. This is stronger than Rashi. Rashi, see, when we read the Rashi, okay, this could lead to this, and therefore, please pay attention to consequences. Over here, Chazal made a much stronger statement than Rashi chose to use in his commentary, and he says, no, this is an example of avera goreret avera. So if it's a sin leading to a sin, ergo, what does that therefore mean? That this is a sin, and that is a sin. In fact, it's saying something which is even stronger. And just listen to this. When it comes to Ben Sora More, is he punished for what he did or for what he may end up doing? Right? Because what he did himself is not capital, it's not a capital offense. So therefore it says that the Ben Sora More is punished for what he's going to end up doing for the future, for anticipating where things are going. Isn't that fascinating? What's the starting point of the Ben Sora More? According to this, it's the Eshifa Torah. So what is the whole attitude of Ben Sora More? It's forward thinking of where this is going to end up, which means, what is it saying? Where did this Ben Sora Mora come from with the death penalty and so on? Where did it come from? It came from the father's poor impulse control. I'll say it again. The kid's poor impulse control comes from the father's poor impulse control. The father's bad choices eventually leads to this, which means this may be an example. You know, one of the other things in this week's parsha talks about a mamzer who's not allowed to marry within the general community. Can I ask you a question? Why did the Torah just now say if you have a forbidden relationship, so the perpetrators become mamzerim? Why punish the kids? Especially in this week's parsha, it says that kids don't get punished for the sins of the father. Right? So why should a mamzer, on a moral level, why should a mamzer suffer? And the answer is, because when it comes to ourselves, when we're facing our own Yetzirah, we're willing to forgive ourselves of any kind. I'll deal with the consequences. But when your kid is going to have a stigma, when your kid is going to suffer the consequences of your decisions, that may be a little bit different. And that's what it's saying over here. Realize that when you go after this woman with a different value system and you're going to bring her home, this is not going to work out very well. And the kid which is going to come from this relationship is going to be at poor impulse control. He's going to be acting out. He's going to be doing all kinds of things. And he's going to be punished for the future consequences. So therefore, this whole section is realize where things go. But it's saying is don't get into the situation. And what it's also telling us is that this whole process is in order to prevent this relationship. Well, the problem of rape actually goes back to another point. And that other point is a huge machloket between the Rishonim, and I don't want to get into it, if not necessarily, unless I get dragged into it, and that is there, according to this whole halacha, is there a battlefield rape and then go through the process? Or is there delayed gratification, and only after the 30 days is there a relationship? As I said, the Rishonim argue about this. the ones who say that it's only after 30 days, only after she went through the conversion process, only after she becomes your wife. So then they say, but how does this really work? Will this really prevent something from taking place in the battlefield? So as I said, the Rishonim argue on that point. There are some surprising things which we never went to war for the Rishonim. They were only collateral damage along the way, right? During the Crusades, we were the collateral damage. We never went to war. I want to go back and to read something that I had wanted you to remember from last week. Source number 3. Perek Kaf Pasuk Yud. Ki tikrav el ir lelachem aleha, v'karat elel l'shalom. When you go out to battle, you first call out in peace. V'yam shalom tancha u'fatcha lach, and if they respond, v'yal kol amin tzaba yelacha lamas v'avducha. They will then pay taxes to you, and they will then be working for you. They will become enslaved. V'imlo tashlim imach, v'asta imcha milchama. If they refuse to accept the conditions and they go to war, v'tzarta aleha, it's at that point that you are allowed to go and, how would you want to translate, v'tzarta? You start the siege, attack. V'natata lecha elokecha b'yadecha, if God allows you to be victorious, he puts you them in your hands. V'kitat kol zechura l'ficharev, by virtue of the fact that they refuse to accept the peace offering, that then puts all of the males, who were part of the fighting force presumably, that places them in a situation where you can kill all of the males. Rakanashim v'tafa b'ma v'kol asheya b'ir, kol shala tavoz lach. And then the women and the children and all the cattle and all of this becomes spoils of war. And at that point, you now can benefit from the spoils of war. I want to go back, because I'm going to say this again. I think to a very large extent, we can't understand what we were reading in the Eishet Tifat Torah source until we understand this source. Now, there's something which maybe is equally, maybe a little less, should also be morally disturbing for us today, and that is the situation of slavery. If anybody wants to, you can access an interesting article from the New York Times. I'm reading an article from an Adam Goodhart, March 7th, 2011, and it's called The Rabbi and the Rebellion. And he tells over a story about a rabbi who, if I'm not mistaken, because I once read about this a couple of years ago, maybe when it first came out, there was a rabbi who I believe came from England, moved to America. This is around 1860, Civil War, slavery, North, South, and he lived in New York. And he, again, you know how sometimes immigrants right away they want to fit in. So he immediately wants to fit in, and he becomes a good citizen. And he writes a whole book about the biblical idea of slavery, completely supporting slavery from a biblical perspective. And some other rabbi then went and attacked him, and he was attacked, and there was a whole debate that had taken place, and he became very, very famous, and so on and so forth. It's called The Bible View of Slavery. His name was Rabbi Morris J. Rafal. Anyway, slavery is something which to modern man, and by the way, we could just stop for a moment, is the situation that took place in the United States. Did it have anything to do with biblical situation of slavery? I think that's highly debatable. But going back to our parsha, or trying to understand how last week's parsha flows into this week's parsha, what did we just read? Because I think that is part of the equation, and I hate to turn things into finances. What was the very end of this point? The very end of the Eishet Tifrat Torah section said that if you did abuse her, then she is not your property. Which means that there was a price that you just now paid for having relations with her. What was the price that you paid? So again, what was the alternative that took place? The alternative, you went to war, and there was there was a conquered population who now worked for us. That's part of being, again, I'm not saying this is a good thing, I'm not saying this is a wonderful thing, but I'm just, again, fit into the biblical perspective. And was there an alternative over here? So the answer is yes, there was an alternative. What was the alternative? The alternative is that she would be property. Because that's what happens to the conquered population. Now, if you decide that you are going to have sexual relations with her, so guess what is actually the law in Judaism, which, by the way, is mentioned multiple times in this week's Parsha in different ways. You're only allowed to have sexual relations with somebody who you happen to be married to. It said, Lo teh kadesh of benot Yisrael. It's the way the Rambam understands the Pasuk. There are other verses over here, as we saw, dealing with the situation and seduction, rape, seduction, and other situations going place. You were only permitted to have sexual relations with somebody that you're married to. So now, the moment that you have relations with her, and I would go either way right now, either according to the opinion that you can have relations back initially by the battlefield or only later, but either way, if you had sexual relations with this woman and you put her through this process, at that moment, she ceased to be property because we don't marry people that are our property. When we marry people, they become, actually, the opposite is true. When we marry people, we now have obligations towards those people. And they are absolutely free. We have obligations of taking care and so on and so forth, which means the moment that you decided that this is a good idea to have sexual relations with her, what happened at that moment is no way can she then be considered to be property, which means there's actually, I don't know if you ever noticed this before, there's actually a financial implication of what you just now did. I don't know how much a female slave or worker would have been on the open market. I don't know, you want to put a number on it right now? Doesn't matter, $1,000, $5,000. So realize how much that cost you just now, that passion that you had, how much this is going to cost you. By the way, did that sound like it had a chance of working a little bit better than the... No, I'm being very serious right now. Is that what the Torah is saying over here is that you want to take her as a wife? Okay, there's a process over here. Therefore, that means she cannot be property. You change your mind, you can't sell her. She's free. Why? Because you have relations with her. She's no longer property. So what the Torah is doing over here is, again, I think that there's something really interesting. I want to say this again. This is not a value judgment which I'm making. It's not that I'm standing here and saying that my 21st century perspective is that this is something which is morally troubling. The Torah is telling you that this is something which is morally troubling. Why? As I said, one word, two words should have given it to you. The hint was b'chashakta, desire, that already was should have been troubling. The second point should have been when it says that she was a victim of abuse. You abused this woman. If she's a victim, that makes you a perpetrator. That itself is something which Chazal doesn't miss. And that's why Ben Azai is able to say it's avera gorera tavera over here. That's why he's able to point and say that there's a sin that took place over here. Why is there a sin? What do you mean there's a sin? What sin took place? Well, you abused somebody. Now, again, it could be, I'm going to say something which, if you want, you can accuse me of apologetics. I've been accused of worse things. But I haven't used one word of apologetics so far today. Yes? So, as I said, you can accuse me of apologetics, but I want to note what the Netziv says. Netziv is in source number 10, and he is trying to solve some of the language in this portion. The hair and the clothing and he's troubled by something else. Why is this woman there by the battlefield? You know, war in antiquity, it's not even all that long ago. Modern war is different because we have weapons that we can shoot from a very far distance. It wasn't all that long ago that there were actually battlefields. Was there still battlefields in World War I, right? Right? World War II? In modern fighting, you don't need a battlefield per se. The battles can take place from a distance. So the Netziv in source number 10 says over here, where it's underlined, Masha ein ken kishiyotzim b'mochama b'sadeh, man l'nashim basham. What are the women doing there? Avakvar b'yarno b'seifa b'reshit, yudalat et zayin. That's where the four kings against the five kings, and Avraham returns the women as well there. So that's the context. Shedarkam haya b'umot olam, when the young men would go out to war, yotzot gamke nashim yafot mekushatot vamdot linase, that the young women would dress up, young marriageable women would dress up, umi bachur shemizderez b'mochama v'ruach gvura nosisabo, kofetzet alav nashim hayafot, v'al pizem mitcharim abachurim ba'oz. So the women he's describing over here is at least as cheerleaders, standing by the battlefield, dressing up as attractively as possible, encouraging the brave soldiers, saying, the most attractive woman, saying to the soldier, the bravest, strongest one, I will marry. So what the Netziv is describing is that these women are actually part of the war effort. They're there encouraging them to take place. And he says, according to what I understand, it would have been the single woman would have dressed up, which means you go to war, and on the other side, again, he's not implying the Jewish women act the same way. He says this is the way that the non-Jewish women would behave. They would dress up, go to war, and encourage their warriors to be brave and strong and valiant, and then promise themselves to the strongest one that would win their hand in marriage. And now something happened. And I do want to now create another subtext in this. Because within my subtext is there's also some degree of paganism. Is because these are generally going to, especially at this time, there's going to be pagans who believe in their pagan gods. They believe their pagan gods are going to guarantee victory. And now something terrible happened. Something terrible happened for the other side. What's the terrible thing that happened? They lost. Which means the valiant soldiers are killed. And now they're standing there, and they should be shocked to the core of their being. Their soldiers are gone. Their God has proven to be of no power, or their gods have proven to be of no power. And now there is this other force, this other side, which has been victorious. Which means, as much as what I'm saying now, again, I don't want to use the word apologetics, but I want to use the word fantasy. So I think that now the fantasy or the imagination would then be, maybe this woman can actually go through some type of an epiphany, and this epiphany would be, is that apparently the gods that I believed in have no power. The men that I was trying to encourage are no longer here. And now comes this man from the other side, from the victorious side. And I do want to go back to what I said a couple of moments before. What are her choices in terms of life right now? Her choices are either to be a slave for the victorious side or to become a wife in the victorious side. What is a better position? A wife is a better position. A wife is a better position because a wife becomes one of equality, and he has obligations to her. And once he even sleeps with her, she can no longer be treated as a slave. She's freed from slavery at that point. Which means the flip side of this, even though indeed the Torah made a value judgment and said that she was victimized over here, nonetheless, within this entire process, if you decide to go down this road, she is going to be a beneficiary in terms of what her stature is going to be by this. Now, again, everything I just said is not that simple. Is not that simple, but it is actually possible that this woman would make a decision that, you know what, he's interested in me. This may be a very good decision for me to make in terms of my possible alternatives. Now, as far as you said the Jewish community or as far as the larger picture goes, is this a really good idea in terms of marriage? Is this the same description when you get married and make your wife happy and you know there's one of romance and one of equality and one of common background and common... Which means, what are the chances of this really working out well? So we go back that, no, this seems to be a very unwise decision. And again, if I didn't say it clearly enough, Rashi quoted, this is Kenegad Yetzirah. That's the Gemara. The Gemara says, this is the Yetzirah at work. This is not the Yetzirah Tov at work. But I'm just pointing out that I can create this larger context where there is this possibility that even though she is victimized, and we can't move away from that, it could be despite being victimized that perhaps of all of the possible situations that could emerge, maybe this, I'll put it this way, is not necessarily the worst one.